From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in today for Terry Gross. My guest is novelist and poet Paul Monette. Monette's lover of 12 years died of AIDS in 1986. Coping with AIDS and death is the subject of Monette's writing, including a memoir, Borrowed Time, and his latest novel, Afterlife. Coming up, we talk to Paul Monette. Also, we meet animator Paul Feerlinger. His award-winning documentary, And Then I'll Stop, is considered the first of its kind to deal with alcoholism. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new solo albums by two old rockers, Dave Edmonds and Nick Lowe. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews A Shock to the System, starring Michael Caine and Peter Riegert. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There's been no let-up in the violence in South Africa's Natal province between rival black factions. At least 15 more people were killed during the day as fighting continued between Zulus of the Inkatha movement and supporters of radical anti-apartheid groups. The BBC's Mike Wooldridge reports from the area.
As I walked into the village of Kwanyandu, four houses were still burning. The body of a 72-year-old woman, apparently shot at close range, lay on a path. That of another woman a few yards further on. The efforts of families in the Edendale Valley to find refuge for their children, especially during these past 3 days of sustained attacks, have been desperate and not without cost. Women in one village said they'd lost several children trying to cross a river with them. Many families are now sheltering in churches and schools, but late this afternoon on the hillside above one village that's become a place of refuge, scores of men were amassing for what looked as if it would be yet another attack. Sporadic gunfire could be heard. Allegations are made consistently by the victims of police inaction in the face of aggression by the Inkatha supporters. On the ground here, there seems to be little confidence that even the face-to-face meeting between Chief Buthelezi and Mr. Mandela will bring an early end to the now endemic violence.
The BBC's Mike Wooldridge. The Centers for Disease Control said today that its long-awaited study of veterans' health found no evidence linking exposure to the dangerous herbicide Agent Orange to increased cancer rates in Vietnam veterans. The study did conclude, however, that Vietnam veterans do show an increased rate of a cancer of the lymphatic system known as non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Citing the study, Veterans Affairs Secretary Edward Derwinski ruled today that despite the lack of connection to Agent Orange, Vietnam veterans suffering from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma are entitled to service-related disability payments. In the first major presidential address on AIDS since the onset of the epidemic, President George Bush called for passage of congressional legislation outlawing AIDS discrimination. NPR's Frank Browning reports.
President Bush told a national group of businessmen concerned about AIDS that the nation must offer compassion for people infected with the AIDS virus.
We must beat this virus. For whether talking about a nation or an individual, character is measured not by our tragedies, but by our response to those tragedies.
AIDS advocates praised Bush for speaking out on AIDS, but criticized him for failing to offer concrete health programs to care for the sick or to mount education programs to prevent the spread of AIDS. Specifically, they said the administration must provide targeted funds for cities whose public health systems are no longer able to care for the AIDS patient load and to provide medicines like the drug AZT for the poor and the uninsured. I'm Frank Browning in Washington.
This is NPR News. The U.S. Senate today narrowly rejected an amendment to the Clean Air Bill that would have provided job relief for coal miners thrown out of work by tougher pollution controls. The amendment, offered by West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd, would have provided a $500 million assistance package for miners who'd lose their jobs as utilities are forced to stop using high-sulfur coal. Regulations to cut sulfur emissions from utilities could threaten the jobs of as many as 5,000 coal miners. The amendment failed by a vote of 50-49. The House of Representatives tonight accepted a Democratic version of a major new federal child care program. They took that plan despite President Bush's threat to veto it. The president backed instead a Republican alternative. NPR's Cokie Roberts explains.
Both plans created a system of so-called earned income tax credits, essentially federal payments to low-income working families. Both required states to provide vouchers for eligible parents to spend in the child care centers of their choice, including those in religious institutions, and both would expand the Head Start program. But the Democratic measure also requires states to develop standards for centers. Republicans argued that would limit a family's choices, and they characterized the chief difference between the proposals as the question of who knew best how to care for children, the government or parents. While Republicans tried to cast their proposal as philosophically different from the Democratic one, Democrats described their plan as more broad-based, providing before and after school care for middle-class children. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
A new study of world temperatures over the past 10 years has found no evidence of the global warming trend predicted by many scientists. The study is the first to be based on temperature data collected by satellite, and its authors say that's much more reliable than ground-based records. The study says there was no measurable warning for the 10-year period from 1979 to 1988. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Writer Paul Monnett's latest novel, Afterlife, is about a new kind of widower, men who have lost their partners to AIDS. Monnett knows this experience firsthand. His lover of 12 years, Roger, died of AIDS in 1986. Monnett took care of Roger during his 19-month battle with the disease. That experience was the basis for Monnett's earlier book, Borrowed Time, an AIDS Memoir. For his new book, Afterlife, Monnett also drew from his own life when he created the central characters, Stephen, Dell, and Sonny, men who have all tested positive for the AIDS virus and are now facing an uncertain future. I asked Paul Monnett to read the final paragraph of his memoir, Borrowed Time.
I drove home trying to beat the dawn and knew it would not even start until morning. Waking teaches you pain. The parents were in the front bedroom, so I took a Dalmain and curled up in Roger's bed, where I still sleep every night, because he is nearer there than anywhere else in the house. When the phone rang at 6, I drifted out of bed and went into the darkened study. Bernice was standing in the hallway door, and we held each other as the machine answered the phone. After the beep, a voice said, "This is UCLA Medical Center calling. Mr. Roger Horowitz died at 5:42 a.m. this morning, October 22nd. Bernice and I hugged each other briefly, without a word, and I swam back to bed for the end of the night, trying to stay under the Dalmain, putting off as long as I could the desolate waking to life alone, this calamity that is all mine, that will not end till I do."
Do you still feel the calamity, and do you still feel that feeling of being alone?
I certainly still feel that I am in the middle of a war. I don't feel quite the sense of desperation right now that I felt when I wrote those lines. The first line of Borrowed Time says, "I don't know if I will live to finish this book." And I did, and I lived to see it published, and I have had a chance to, you know, be part of the debate around AIDS. So I am still in the middle of the war. I'm not alone. I did meet a wonderful man about a year and a half ago, Stephen Kolzak, and cautiously, we decided to make a relationship because we were highly aware that one or the other of us would get sick sooner or later, and I might find myself in the same position of taking care of someone. Stephen was diagnosed about a year ago, and he's had a pretty rough time of it. I have not yet been diagnosed. The antiviral drugs have managed to keep me well so far.
You talk about, in the end of Borrowed Time, about using up your optimism in taking care of your lover, Roger. Is that still true? Does it still feel like that reserve of optimism is very low?
Curiously, Marty, there's a certain... I have a cockeyed kind of optimism in me, despite the darkness of the plague, about gay and lesbian culture, and I have an enormous sense of pride about the, you know, about my people. I feel as if I'm writing for the future of my people as well. I, you know, people often ask me, have things gotten better or worse in the horrors of AIDS? In almost every way, things have gotten worse because the cases keep accumulating and accumulating and accumulating, and the pain and suffering that families and friends go through around an AIDS death is appalling. I think that things have polarized more than that they've improved. I think that we have achieved the 1,000 points of light around AIDS.
Meaning that people are helping each other.
Yes, I think people are helping each other. I think the gay community has proven a model of trying to educate its population. And I think wonderful, wonderful people have volunteered in AIDS organizations all over the country. And I meet them when I travel everywhere and am very, very moved by their passion and their commitment. For me, a lot of the despair that I think you are picking up at the end of Borrowed Time has been, there's a kind of lightning rod that has made it for me into a kind of political activism, and that is not to say that I will not be despairing when I'm sick and I expect to die from AIDS, but I hope it's sometime in the future, and meanwhile there's a lot to be done.
Your new novel is a novel. And I'm wondering what a novel does to the characters and to the story for the person who writes it. Do you have a different relationship to a book when it's something that comes from your imagination as opposed to something that you've actually lived through?
Well, Afterlife was a conscious attempt on my part to try to tell another story beyond my own, to try to talk about what it's like for all of us who are seropositive, who live in this sort of suspended animation, some of us waiting to get sick, some of us convincing ourselves that we won't. I wanted to show what denial was like in its positive dimensions and in its negative dimensions. There are three AIDS widowers in Afterlife. One of them is a young man who is still full of a compulsive sexuality, who is convinced he will never get AIDS. One of them is so full of rage that he becomes an AIDS terrorist. I think that man, he's Hispanic, I think that man might well have become a member of ACT UP a year later. This book takes place in the fall of 87, and his rage ends up consuming him. The third character is very much based on me, and that character longs for intimacy again and finally is able to achieve a relationship with someone on the battleground, someone else who's seropositive. It's always useful to remember that there are a million or a million and a half or 2 million people like me out there. A lot of people don't know their seropositive status. To meet me, I certainly don't seem HIV positive. I don't glow in any particular way.
Just your necktie.
Just my necktie glows, right. of course, most people who are seropositive don't know their status. Most people still haven't been tested. We who are in the AIDS activist community long for everybody to be tested because we want more political activism to come from those people. And with so many people in denial and so frightened to be tested, they cannot demand that kind of national political will that I think we need.
The three characters you talk about, Steve, Dell, and Sonny, all lost their lovers to AIDS at pretty much the same time. How did you find, in your own case, that men could comfort each other when they had lost someone to that disease?
I do think that the comfort system that I had around me was huge and very moving, because Roger and I had so many friends, gay and straight, and had lived a very happy life in Los Angeles and had wonderful families that were very, very proud of us and very proud of our relationship. We had, I mean, going into the horrors that we had to endure, we had the most deeply rooted and sweet-tempered support system that we could. People helped me the best they could. You do have to go through that experience of loss alone. It's just a very, very, very terrible business. But I certainly have felt in the couple of years since my grief, since the pitch of my grief abated, I have felt this sense of wanting my life to mean something. I suppose if I were an older man, my mother passed away a couple of weeks ago, and I share now with my father this business of widowhood, and I know that a lot of older people who become widowed just want peace and quiet and,
you want that?
With their thoughts. For me, no. I mean, maybe it's because I'm 44 years old and I lost someone so young. For me, it's important to be active. A lot of people say, well, why don't you just travel and have a good time? And I do try to do all those things, but writing is really what I need to do. My pen does feel like a sword, and so that's what I do.
Let me read just one small section in here. This is Dell, the person that you talked about, that if the character was real, perhaps would belong to ACT UP. But he says he believed the opposite of everything now that the anger had gone underground. It was all mixed up in his head with the Mayan gods of fire and blood, the stories Marcus had told him about the altars high on the pyramids, where a prisoner's heart was torn from his chest, still beating. That was the god Dell yearned for late at night, a force equal to his own fury. Not even revenge was enough of a reason to believe, for he couldn't pin the enemy down to any one man. Chaos was what mattered, watching the world unstring itself with just a snip of the thread here and there. Do you identify with that rage?
I do identify with that rage. I hope that I have made my own rage more constructive in a way. I'll tell you that I was shocked and thrilled when I saw Born on the 4th of July and Enemies this year, because I identified with the rage of those Vietnam veterans, and I identified with that sense of delirious disconnection
and desperation
that all those people in Enemies felt. And I remember watching the parents of all those children who were lost in the Lockerbie disaster on one of the Nightline shows or Primetime Live, and they were screaming at this ambassador, "You're a liar, you're a liar." And one woman got up and said, "When I lost my daughter, I lost my country." And I remember thinking, they're as angry as we are. We were very, very angry at our country. I don't think it makes us bad citizens, but I think that we are trying to make the society pay attention to a great many things. I mean, after all, the health care crisis around AIDS is only part of such an enormous health care crisis that threatens all of us.
My guest is writer Paul Monette. His new novel is titled Afterlife. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Monette is my guest, and his latest book, it's a novel, is called Afterlife, and it's published by Crown. And I should just say that his other book, which he wrote a couple years ago, called Borrowed Time, an AIDS Memoir, has just been published in paperback by Avon Books. You've said that you are attracted to love stories, or that you've always written love stories, and I'm curious about your attraction.
I think some of that must come from the fact that a gay person spends a lot of his early life in the closet, and all of his feelings about love and romance are internal and internalized and, in a way, fatalistic. I mean, certainly when I was a teenager, long ago in the dark ages, it was such a closeted time. I guess I didn't really ever believe that I would connect up with someone.
An unrequited love. Then.
Yeah, well, remember, a gay person tends to feel like he's the only one in the world when he's growing up. That's the pernicious influence of the closet, I think. When you finally come out, for me it happened in my mid-20s, for a lot of people I think now it happens in their early 20s and their late teens, there's such a sense of release. Your heart almost hurts with the notion that you might actually now be able to love somebody. And I was able to because I met someone wonderful and we were together for 12 wonderful years, I think that I really was able to write love stories with a great sense of optimism and vividness. I mean, I believe in love stories, I suppose, the way Jane Austen did, that, you know, you just take these two marvelous people and, God, do you want them to get together by the end of the book? That's what's impelled me as a writer. But I think that the love story has been I think you were quoting the New York Times, I said there that the love story has been ceded to the bargain basement of romance novels and soap operas. I mean, that's really where love stories are told. And I have nothing against trashy stories, and I have nothing against trashy art forms. But high art tends to be, and serious literature tends to be very ironic about love and very skittish about it. And I think that says a lot about our own dysfunctions around passion and love and the difficulty we all have trying to bring together our sense of passion and our deeper, more philosophical sense of love.
You begin, and you said this earlier, you begin Borrowed Time with a sentence, "I don't know if I will live to finish this." How do you live knowing your own mortality? I mean, we all have that, but I think when you test positive for something like AIDS, your mortality is more real than something I might be living with that I don't even know about.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of positive denial in me that keeps me vital from day to day and keeps me forceful about my writing from day to day. Ernst Becker talks in The Denial of Death about the fact that if we didn't have some kind of denial, we couldn't get up in the morning because the sense of mortality is so enormous around us. If my numbers begin to drift down or I need to go from one antiviral to another, though I have I can be very, very shaken. And I don't know. I mean, my well-meaning friends say to me, "You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. You look terrific, and the medication is going to be there for you, and ultimately we're going to be able to manage this disease." Well, I think ultimately we're going to be able to manage this disease, and we'll have drugs to manage it the way insulin manages diabetes. But we are not there at all yet, and I try to say to some of those friends, don't belittle my own sense of mortality. Sometimes I really need to talk that through, and sometimes I need to say, well, wait a minute, what if I've only got 6 months or a year, or I could wake up tomorrow with a lymphoma, and I don't want to deny my friend Stevens. Sometimes he hits the wall of coping because he has to give himself medication through a catheter every day, and he has to take chemotherapy every couple of weeks, and I try to say to him all the time, "You look terrific, Stevie, you're doing great," but he needs sometimes to talk about that mortal edge. And, you know, what if I only have 6 months left? He says to me sometimes, "I'm not finished playing with you." Well, it breaks my heart. All you can do is live one day at a time. You know that, Marty, as well as I do. And that's what we, I think, are taught. That's what the battering of adulthood teaches you anyway. And you try to really relish what you can achieve with your emotions and in your relationships in any given day.
Do you find that you're getting to know this virus? I feel sort of awkward even asking you that, but I think sometimes even people begin to identify themselves with their illness, but that somehow as it's lived in you, you begin to recognize its form.
Well, I certainly know exactly the way in which it's my enemy, and I know exactly the way in which it breaks down people and dehumanizes them. On this book tour, I met a friend in one of the cities that I visited whom I hadn't seen in a couple of years. And it was really a shock to see him because he's been sick and he was just changed. He just didn't look like himself anymore. And even I was shocked by that. I would say, though, that I think most of us who are AIDS activists feel that we're not really dying of AIDS. We're coping with AIDS as well as we can. We're dying of homophobia. I think this polarization of attitudes has really happened more and more in the last few years. But I have to confront that, and I think one needs to confront it.
I want to get into some of those issues in just a minute, but I do want to ask you something else about your own personal struggle with this virus and whether even you look in the mirror more and whether you are more conscious of even just watching yourself and seeing how you look.
I probably do. I'm not sure. I wouldn't put that down to vanity more than the virus. But I know how many friends of mine who have watched their bodies change with AIDS find the mirror a very troublesome business. I am very, very happy that I have lived to be 44 years old, and I feel as if I really did become a man in my life. That's one of the things I say in one of my poems to Roger. Thank God we had a chance to become men together and to really understand the need to have an ethics and a sense of commitment to ourselves and our societies. And For me, it's very painful to watch the death of someone like Keith Haring at the age of 31, or Willie Smith at the age of 30, and my friend Stephen is only 37. They've barely had a chance to get out of their youth, and this has cut them down. That loss, I think, we will be measuring for decades to come. The loss of so much talent and energy. Of course, there are you know people bursting with talent to take up the baton. But you know, how do you replace someone like Michael Bennett? You just don't.
No. One of your characters, Steve, says that when he goes to get his blood count, he feels like he's getting his college board scores. And it reminded me whether the kind of competition you have with other people in the class and the kind of competition you have with the test itself.
Yes.
You feel that?
Yes, very definitely. But both of those things are very sharp remarks on your part. The going and getting your numbers is such a surreal business. And my numbers went down between January and February. Or actually between October and January, and I felt as if I had failed. I was in a slump for a few weeks, and then they happened to drift up again. And, you know, the numbers are so, they jump around so much. And I felt, you know, this sense of triumph that I'd won something when they went up again. It's just a natural thing but you go to this kind of sense of execution when you go get the numbers every couple of months.
Paul Monette is my guest, and his latest book is called Afterlife, and a book he wrote a couple years ago called Borrowed Time, an AIDS memoir, has just been published in paperback. Is the gay community in a danger of being too obsessed with the disease of AIDS to the detriment of other issues? And I'm thinking of things like the legalization of marriage contracts, sodomy laws, housing and job discrimination, armed forces discrimination. Is the community so consumed with AIDS that there are other issues that are important that are not getting the attention they deserve?
Well, I certainly know that there are people who feel that way in the gay community. I don't feel that way. I don't feel that AIDS is an obsession. I mean, first of all, we have to understand that, you know, we have the most serious health crisis of the 20th century leaching into our society more and more. And it happens that white heterosexual males are probably safe from this virus, but they're about the only people that are safe from it. But to get back to what you said about the gay community, yes, we do want to be seen as a minority group that has been discriminated against the way blacks have been, the way women have been, the way Jews have been. And our revolution is 20 years old, and I really don't think there has been all that much of a blip in the revolution, despite the enormity of the calamity of AIDS. One of the things that AIDS made happen, it would have happened anyway, but one of the things that AIDS made happen is a bringing together of gay men and lesbians. We are not at odds with one another as we were during the 70s. There was a sense that lesbians found their greatest comfort in the feminist movement and that they felt very distanced from men whom they thought of as part of the oppressor culture of men. And I think a lot of that has transitioned into a really different place. There's an enormous amount of work we need to do about homophobia. Any work we do as gay and lesbians out of the closet to educate our families and our friends and our coworkers about being gay, to make them see that we are human and what our humanness is to make a stand against that homophobia. And that's the biggest battle we're in, AIDS or not.
Paul Monette, thank you very much.
Very glad to be here, Marty.
Paul Monette's latest novel is titled Afterlife. His earlier book about taking care of his lover who died of AIDS is called Borrowed Time. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a concert of contemporary Latin American guitar music with the Assad Brothers. I hope you can join us. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. When animator Paul Feerlinger started making his documentary about alcoholism, he was a bottle-a-day drinker. During the making of the film, he stopped drinking and has been sober in the years since. Coming up, we talk to Paul Feerlinger about his recovery. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new solo albums by musicians who came out of the British pub rock scene of the 70s, Dave Edmunds and Nick Lowe. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Michael Caine's latest movie, A Shock to the System. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The U.S. Attorney's Office in San Diego issued an indictment today, charging five people and two British companies with conspiracy to smuggle top-secret electronic devices to Iraq. The indictment says the devices were triggers for nuclear weapons. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The indictment says a London-based firm called Euromac contacted a California company called CSI Technologies in order to arrange the purchase and shipment of devices known as Crytrons. They are small electronic devices that have several commercial purposes, but are mainly used for nuclear weapons. The British company Euromac was run by a naturalized Briton of Iraqi descent. The Customs Service arranged for one of its undercover agents to handle the negotiations of the illegal deal. The investigation resulted in yesterday's arrest of six people in London. The indictment charges Euromac and its employees with conspiracy to export defense articles and money laundering. But it remains unclear whether the accused will ever be extradited to the U.S. because they must first face charges in Britain. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Today, the Department of Veterans Affairs decided to grant disability benefits to Vietnam veterans afflicted with a rare cancer. But the government said the cancer was not related to the herbicide Agent Orange, so thousands of veterans who believe other maladies are caused by that chemical will not be compensated. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The Veterans Department today declared that a rare cancer called non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is a service-related condition. That means people with a disease will get disability benefits, and their widows and children will get pensions, too. Today's decision is based on a new study from the Centers for Disease Control, which found that Vietnam vets were at a slightly higher risk for contracting this rare cancer. Veterans groups have argued that the cancer is caused by Agent Orange, a defoliant used in Vietnam. But today's study suggested just the opposite. The people most likely to get the cancer served on ships off the coast, and they rarely, if ever, came into areas where Agent Orange was used. The VA's decision will benefit some 1,800 people who have filed claims with the government over service-related cancers, but it ignores the claims of another 35,000 veterans who believe their illnesses are due to exposure to Agent Orange. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The House of Representatives passed a $27 billion child care bill today. The measure would allow parents to use federal money at church-run daycare centers. The bill is backed by the Democratic leadership. Opponents said it unfairly limited parental choice because it requires states to set child care standards, and they warned President Bush would veto the measure. The House bill relies on income tax credits for low-income families and gives smaller sums to existing children's programs. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher wants West Germany to remain in the NATO alliance. She said tonight U.S. and British troops should stay in the United Germany. Prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 16 points to close at 2727.70. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Veteran rockers Dave Edmunds and Nick Lowe both have new solo albums, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of them. Here's a bit of Dave Edmunds' title cut, Closer to the Flame.
Closer to the flame. Dave Edmonds and Nick Lowe have a few things in common. They both like old-fashioned rock and roll. Both of them are first-rate producers, having created hits for acts as various as The Pretenders, The Stray Cats, Elvis Costello, The Fabulous Thunderbirds, and John Hyatt. They're both middle-aged guys, and neither of them has had much success. That's King of Love from Dave Edmonds' new album, Closer to the Flame. It's one of the album's better songs, an echo of 50s rockabilly combined with 90s crispness and clarity. Closer to the Flame sounds in general like a desperation move, though, the work of an excellent rock musician who doesn't have the foggiest idea what a mass audience might like. This leads him to record treacles such as this song, Stockholm. Although Dave Edmonds and Nick Lowe share a certain embattled musical heritage, pop fans who came of age in the punk era when pop was despised, they're really very different. Edmonds is a stylistic chameleon, switching voices and sounds seemingly at will, making music that sounds clever but anonymous. When you put on a Nick Lowe album, however, you know you're getting Nick Lowe. As far as I'm concerned, Nick Lowe has the sound I like. He creates instantly memorable melodies and sings clever lyrics in his flat, conversational voice. Lowe's new album called Party of One was produced by Dave Edmonds, and both his and Edmonds' albums share a drummer, the great old pro Jim Keltner. But there's no doubt in my mind that Lowe has made the better record.
There's a cool wind blowing in the sound of happy people. At a party given for the gay and debonair, there's an organ blowing in the breeze for the dancers hid behind the trees. But I ain't never gonna see what's shaking on the hill.
Nick Lowe is modest to a fault, yet he's also an eminently sensible fellow who seems to know his place in the musical world. He was recently quoted as saying, "I'll never be Merle Haggard or Muddy Waters. I'm just a middle-class English geezer who's listened to lots of this stuff and knows some really good musicians." But this doesn't explain a new, quirkily original song like Guy Gin Man.
Touchdown, the Rita Facciente.
If you were wondering, yes, that was Ry Cooder on guitar. Nick Lowe has filled Party of One with a succession of wonderfully goofy songs and couplets like, "Well, do you remember Rick Astley? He had a big fat hit. It was ghastly." Nick Lowe has never had a big hit. He deserves one. It would never be ghastly.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. This is Fresh Air. In Paul Feerlinger's new animated documentary, And Then I'll Stop, you hear the voices of alcoholics who have come face to face with their own addiction. One of the voices is Feerlinger's own. The film is the first animated documentary to explore the issue of alcoholism. It just won an award for Best Film from the International Association of Animators Festival in New York. And Then I'll Stop will be shown this weekend at the Museum of Modern Art as part of this year's New Directors, New Film series. When I spoke with Paul Feerlinger, I wanted to know why he wanted to make a film about alcoholism, especially his own. He told me he didn't want to make the film. Rather, he was approached by his distributor, Pyramid Films.
They challenged me to make a film on substance abuse. And they didn't know it, but at that time I was a bottle-a-day drinker.
Now, did you know that you were an alcoholic at the time?
I called myself at that time, bravely, a functioning alcoholic.
And how well did you function?
I thought I did all right. I functioned so that I made money. That's as far as I functioned. And I took on the film, and the way I approached it was I asked a friend of mine who's a counselor in a rehab to interview people in various stages of recovery. And so I had something like 25 hours of tapes of various people from young to old and men and women and poor and rich. And listening to them, I recognized myself in every one of those stories. So at that point, I decided that I have to quit.
I noticed in the documentary that when you drew alcoholism, the lines were jaggedy and
were
the colors were dark. But when you have the picture, for instance, of recovery and of an AA meeting, there's soft colors. The shapes are round. There's a kind of warmth to it that you don't see in the mm-hmm. alcoholic part.
That's wonderful that you noticed that. You're the first one. No one has really told that. And it was an intention. I had intended to do it rough, black and white in the beginning. And as the stories progress, then bring in more color. And so that it won't be a preachy film. So the viewer will get the feeling of feeling better along with the people in recovery without being told that now they are better people. Or feeling better people.
Well, did you feel that sort of dark, jaggedy line when you were an alcoholic?
Well, when I started the film, then I was heavily into my addiction. The thing is, I had to throw out about 5 minutes, the first 5 minutes of the film, and start all over again. So So what you see in that film was all done sober.
Hmm.
But the feelings were still there.
Was it hard to work sober? Hard to get used to working sober?
It was in the beginning, because I drank at work. I started in the morning, and I had a glass next to me all day long and all night.
So you just nursed this glass along?
I just sort of sipped all day long. I never got into falling down the steps or anything like that. But I was just soaked all day long. So that was strange in the beginning. And I learned all sorts of things like how to make proper tea the proper way and spend time making it.
And is that something that almost, it keeps your hands busy?
Yep.
Yeah. You say in this film that the only feeling that you knew was anger.
Was anger. Yeah, I had anger is a terrible part of addiction, and it's something that people around me, my family thought, they really thought that I have a brain tumor.
Because of your irrational behavior?
Yeah, because of my behavior. And they were so used to me drinking all the time that no one even thought of considering that. So I knew that I had these terrible fits that just tore me inside. And I felt that there's something wrong with me. So it was real insanity, and I had no problem admitting that when I had to decide.
What other feelings, then, have you added to your repertoire of feelings since you've been sober?
See, I started drinking, and almost instantly, heavily drinking, at the age of 15. And I guess my spiritual development stopped around that age, 15 to 18. So I had to learn in the past year everything that I had missed all those years.
You must be busy.
30. It's true. It's true. It's a good way of putting it.
I noticed that when you were drawing somebody, one of the people in the film's alcoholism, that they cut themselves in half. There's a scene where the head stays still and the body keeps moving. A real disconnection.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what many alcoholics talk about? That they've sort of split themselves in two?
Yeah, that's what I did in the film. I actually tried to draw something that the people were trying to say, or what I thought that they would draw if they could draw. And the scene you're mentioning is, it's a white collar type of he's a vice president in a corporation, and so everything I drew him with straight lines, so so it just came out of that more than thinking of him as a how did you put it, a split personality? You didn't
say
that.
Someone sort of divided
and disconnected.
In half. Disconnected.
It just came more out of the lines than what you had mentioned.
Have you shown this film to other people who are alcoholics? And I'm interested in what their response is to it.
For me, it's rewarding because everyone, it does what I wanted to do. Everyone finds a little bit of his story in it. And what's even more rewarding is when I show this at a festival or places like that, or even at a business meeting where I'm looking for work, let's say, and someone will come to me afterwards or catch me on the street and will want to talk to me about his addiction. Every single time it happens. So the film is really working.
Well, is there something about animation that is a kind of friendly approach to a problem? I mean, it takes some of the sting and the barbs out of it.
It's, I think, this type of animation, which is hard to describe because it is not always cartoon animation. It is not funny animation, although it has some humor in it. Then I think it's an illustration of thoughts or of feelings. And people aren't used to that. They're used to talking heads and soap opera kind of dramatizations. And by now, they have those kinds of approaches have ceased to be effective because there's just too much of it. So I think it's effective because of that. And also, when you see a drawing of somebody or somebody's voice, then you don't really see the... Nobody is telling you what the person looks like.
Somebody is telling you. Anonymity.
Right, that's it. And it's telling you what the person has in his mind, not what's on his face.
I'm interested in how you begin with your drawings and whether you start with the nose, because you seem to like noses a lot.
That's incredible that you knew that.
Well, they're very... They're very not just prominent, but they just it all seems to start with the nose. Yeah,
they point
exactly.
I start with the nose, just above the ground.
Just above the ground. Well, is that what you notice on people's faces? Are you a particularly attracted to noses?
The center of the face, I guess. I don't know. I think it's more. I've often questioned myself because people do notice that and they make fun of me. Other artists, because not everyone starts with a nose.
Well, I half expected when I saw you today to see a big nose on your face. I don't know why. I just thought maybe you would have one.
Do I?
No. And then where do you go from there? I mean, in terms of... And the reason I ask this is that your characters are very fluid, and they have a kind of shimmering quality to them. And sometimes they turn into a squiggle, and then they turn into a note, and then they turn back into a person again. And I'm interested how you think of that.
I start with the soundtrack. Sound is very important for me. So I have a composer, a sound man, Paul Messing, who works with me every day when I work. So we work very closely. And the day I could afford to have my own sound equipment, to have my own sound studio, that day my work improved just several 100%.
Well, what are you working on now? And I don't know whether sometimes that's bad luck to talk about, but are you working on more things, for instance, in this whole addiction field that you've done?
I would like to. I would like to make a second part of this film on the spirituality of healing. And it seems to be very difficult to find a source of funds for that film because people are very scared of this subject. And I think I could handle it in a non-preachy, non-sentimental way. And that's something I would like to do very much.
Animator Paul Feerlinger, his new film, And Then I'll Stop, shows this weekend at the Museum of Modern Art. It's part of the new director's new film series. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and co-host Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us what they have for us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. The Child Care Bill and the Clean Air Bill are going to be voted on today in the House and Senate, respectively, and we'll have reports on both major pieces of legislation, which have been stuck for some time but are moving again now. There have been some more indictments in the attempt to smuggle nuclear triggers out of this country and into Iraq. And the president made his first major speech on AIDS today and said he was putting his administration on a wartime footing to fight AIDS.
Okay, Linda, thanks. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie, A Shock to the System, is a corporate satire with a contemporary bent and a wicked twist. Guest film critic Owen Gleiberman has this review.
Michael Caine may be better than any actor alive at making scoundrels seem sympathetic. In A Shock to the System, Caine, once again, is playing a rogue who draws us into a conspiracy with him, the same way he did in Alfie and Hannah and Her Sisters. Only this time, his character is going to go farther, much farther. A Shock to the System is a black comedy played very close to the bone. It's also one of the most enticingly intimate portraits of American corporate life ever put on screen. Kane plays Graham Marshall, a successful New York advertising executive. Graham has had a long and fruitful career, but between his acquisitive wife and a recent move to the Connecticut suburbs, he can barely make his mortgage payments. He really needs the promotion he's up for, and besides, he's earned it. Unfortunately, Graham's company has been snapped up by a conglomerate, and a new breed of executive is taking over. Suddenly, the office is crawling with tight-lipped yuppies who win the boss's respect precisely because they never let humanity interfere with their work. This is all disgusting to Graham. He's never let his zest for business stop him from being a nice guy. Now, just as he's getting ready to celebrate the promotion he's sure is his, he finds out the job has slipped through his fingers.
I certainly want you to stay on. It's just... they felt when it came to head of department.
What? Felt what?
There's a general opinion that you weren't in somehow with the new program, that you were...
What are you telling me, George?
You didn't get it, Graham. You're not the one.
Full of bile and fear, Graham discovers a way to beat the cutthroats at their own game. He becomes a meticulous, cold-blooded killer. And when he does, he feels good, thrilled by his newfound power. Kane gives one of the best performances of his career. It's as if he were playing Jekyll and Hyde at the same time. You keep rooting for him, even as you're appalled by his behavior. And so the film pulls you into deeper and deeper levels of amoral glee. Yet Kane never diminishes the itch in Graham's soul. That's what makes him a great actor and a great comedian. A Shock to the System plays off the incredible empathy Michael Caine inspires. Watching these executive power plays through his eyes, we get a feel for how the ritual humiliations of corporate life have been intensified in the takeover era. Director Jan Eggleston has never made a commercial feature before, but his touch is sly and stylish. He gets pungent performances from a lot of familiar faces, including Swoozy Kurtz as Graham's obnoxious wife, John McMartin as his poignantly weary office comrade, and Peter Riegert, who's superb as Graham's loathsome rival. A Shock to the System is never richer than when Kane and Riegert are facing off over the question of which man will light the other's cigar. The movie is juicy fun, a high comedy about the personality of power.
Owen Gleiberman is the film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblaitis. Roberta Shorrock directed today's show. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, join me for a concert with the Brazilian guitar duo Sergio and Odair Assad. Also, I'll speak with writer Paul Auster about his latest novel, Moon Palace. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. That and more next time on Fresh Air.